With a chronic disease patient, there will be multiple inputs that is driving that patient's illness. And so whilst a medication may or may not work effectively across a couple of pathways, there may be thousands of pathways that also need to be looked at and resolved over time. And that takes a lot of work, both from the practitioner and from the patient. So you've got to team up. You've got to be brutally honest about how long this is going to take. And you've got to really put the work in.
Pete Williams is the founder of Functional Medicine Associates. He is most interested in how and why an illness occurs in an individual. I'm Liz Earle, and welcome to the Liz Earle Wellbeing Show. This is the podcast that helps us all have a better second half. And it's my mission to find ways for all of us to thrive in later life by investing in our health and our well-being today. Well, this is the first episode of 2024. So today I want to look to the future of healthcare by understanding functional medicine. This is a real whole body approach to healthcare, and I've noticed it becoming such a buzzword right now. And it's an area of healthcare and wellness that I've been delving into while researching for my new book, A Better Second Half, out at the end of April 2024. And I've become increasingly convinced that it's the future for genuine wellness, not just about treating the symptoms of disease, but addressing their root cause and protecting our health as we age. Well, Pete is an exercise and physical scientist. We actually met about 25 years ago, I worked out, when he founded a high-end gym in London. And in 2013, he was in the first worldwide cohort to be awarded Institute for Functional Medicine Certified Practitioner status and has represented the Institute as a clinical innovator. He was an early adopter of the Professor Dale Bredesen training to better understand neurodegeneration and has treated people with a really wide range of chronic diseases, all of which we'll come to during this conversation. Pete has over 20 years of experience applying functional medicine in clinical practice. So, what does a truly personalised approach to medical care look like?
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Pete, welcome. And let's start with you. And I know that you're going to be very humble about this, but as an old friend of mine, I mean, I was looking at the dates. It must be at least 25 years ago, I think, that we first met. I am going to say that you are a highly accomplished individual working in this space. You're a real pioneer. And, you know, I am so impressed by your level of detail and your research and everything, this journey that you've been on for the last, you know, two decades or more. Where did your personal interest and your understanding, I guess, of functional medicine begin?
Yeah, it's a good question. I suppose the first half of my career really is, and I think still now, is that I'm an exercise scientist. I have a couple of degrees in exercise science, and I've always been interested in exercise as it applies to health and general populations. And that's fantastic now, because I think the research coming out with regards to exercise as a modality to create better health, it's probably the poly pill for all ills. So it is probably the primary intervention that anyone can do for the best outcomes. Mm-hmm. Certainly, obviously, that was my original background. I had a very small little lifestyle medicine clinic in the central London, around about 95. Mm-hmm. And it's actually an osteopathic friend of mine said, there's a guy coming into London. He only comes once a year. You should go and listen to him. It's right down your alleyway. And this guy was called Dr. Jeffrey Bland, who is, if you like, renowned and known as the godfather of functional medicine. Yes. And he did a full day lecture on, his lecture was titled The Heart on Fire. And it really was a sort of real deep dive with regards to a more updated understanding about what causes heart disease. And it was so completely different to anything I've ever heard before. The way he presented the science, the storytelling, and the science as well, it just completely blew me away. I'd never heard a different side to cardiovascular disease like this. And that was it for me. This was 96. Mm-hmm. And he had set up the Institute for Functional Medicine that had been going for about 15 years or so before I ever went to any of his lectures. And so I knew that pretty much from that lecture, that was going to change my career. I got involved with the Institute for Functional Medicine late 90s, 96, 97. And then I suppose the second half of my career from there was really going through all the postgraduate education with regards to understanding functional medicine and understanding how to apply it. Mm. And obviously I have a central London clinic. We've been going now, as I said, 95, 96. So it's very well established. We've seen thousands of patients. And I suppose that I know functional medicine is becoming more and more of a term that more people are being more aware with. I think the beauty for us is that we've probably been in the trenches for 25 years. So not only do we have a probably really good understanding of functional medicine, we also have had the capacity to apply it over several decades. And I think that gives us just a much deeper understanding of how things apply and play out with individuals.
Yeah, so, in real life experience with your team.
I think there's a lot around with regards to, hey, there's this new side of medicine and it's going to solve everything. And whilst, you know, I think very experienced practitioners in functional medicine do have this unique capacity to take someone who maybe has been seen through conventional medicine pathways and has not got any work, you have this capacity to look at an individual in a very different way. And so you're not practicing acute medicine. What you're doing is trying to understand not just how you work with those patients' symptoms and try and resolve the symptoms, but also try to take the root cause approach and really work with someone from a chronic disease and try and work out over time how you can make them better. And it's like everything in life, the more you've had the capacity to work, the more experience you've had, just the sort of better you get at being able to play that out.
I think what's really impressive about the work of functional medicine practitioners and the extraordinary success rates is that you are often given really chronic diseases and issues. You know, people will come to you when they've exhausted pretty much all conventional routes. You know, you talk about the difference between acute care medicine, which, you know, obviously you need immediate treatment for something right now.
Agreed. Yeah.
You know, but these long-term chronic issues, our healthcare system just doesn't seem to have caught up, particularly in terms of nutritional advances or, you know, even, you know, using exercise as prescriptive medicine. And yet, even though people will come to you when all else has failed, you are still able to get extraordinary results. What does that mean for you as a practitioner when you have that kind of whole body approach? Because you're obviously doing a deep dive into why that person is presenting with all these symptoms in the first place, not just fixing the symptoms, but fixing the person.
Well, look, I think you've done a really good description of what you're trying to achieve. I think the key for me is that people have to accept that if they come to us, they're going to get a very different process. And they're also going to have a pretty honest conversation about what is going to need to be done. And also what I would say on that is that A lot of the time, it's going to need the best of conventional medicine and the best of functional medicine, particularly the right. The real chronic ones, because they may be on polypharmacy. They're on a whole host of medications, and
you can't just stop that, can you?
No, you can't. So there's a fine balance. I think what I've got quite good at is that when a patient comes in, you just intuitively now know, even at the sort of best pace that you can go with this patient, how long maybe this journey is going to take for them to get better. Because a lot of this is that they're going to have to change quite considerably some significant aspects of their lifestyle. And what I would say on that is that when a patient's ready to make all the changes, it's not that difficult for us to get them better. Because again, if you've been doing this for quite a long time, you have a pretty good understanding of maybe some of the underlying pathways that need to be looked at and maybe need to be solved. Mm-hmm. But then you've got to have a patient who is, number one, incredibly compliant, and number two, will accept that this journey isn't going to be easy.
No, it's not just take this medicine, take a pill, that they're going to have to put the work in, aren't they?
Yeah, so look, I think this is where I always have a really robust conversation at the beginning about what's going to be involved. And I think, if you look, I suppose, at a conventional medicine sort of strategy, a lot of the time it is dominated by pharmaceuticals. Now, I'm not suggesting that's the wrong thing at all, but what I am suggesting is that here's the pill for your ill. Mm-hmm. Now, with a chronic disease patient, there will be multiple inputs that is driving that patient's illness. And so whilst a medication may or may not work effectively across a couple of pathways, there may be thousands of pathways that also need to be looked at and resolved over time. And that takes a lot of work, both from the practitioner and from the patient. So you've got to team up, you've got to be brutally honest about how long this is going to take, mm-hmm. and you've got to really put the work in, Liz. Mm-hmm. It's like everything mm-hmm. in life. If you're not yeah. prepared to put the work in, and also prepare that you never get good outcomes unless there's a little bit of pain involved.
Right.
It's not going to be easy. And so we've got to be very, very clear with patients at the beginning that yes, you're coming to us. Yes, we may be able to help you, but you're going to have to do a lot of work on yourself to be able to get us to that point.
Mm. And I think allow the time as well. It's a bit like when we gain weight, we might steadily gain weight over the years. And then you think, oh, I'm going to go on a quick fix diet and lose it all in 6 weeks. I mean, it's just not going to happen, isn't it? It's going to take as long potentially to lose the weight as it took to put on. And I guess the same might be true in certain healthcare conditions that, if your condition's been going on for years, it's going to take a little bit of time, isn't it, to unravel it. And as part of that process, you talk about assessing the patient. What kind of diagnostic tests do you do and do you rate that perhaps fall outside of conventional medicine?
Good question. So when we take a patient on, we have very robust sort of background with regards to intake forms, and generally the way we tend to work and I tend to work is that I'll probably spend maybe a couple of hours just sitting with the file. Obviously they've done a very robust intake form, and I like to scribble and get an understanding about where I'm going from that. We bring them then in for a 2-hour consultation, Liz, and what we're trying to do there is I'm trying to develop a sort of a strategy in my head with this patient that is, number one, dealing with and immediate, what are we going to do now? What are we needing to do midterm? And what are we needing to do long term? Because what that allows me to do is to strategize where we may need to go to testing and how we do that testing as well. So let me give you an example of that, is that you may have a patient who's come in who's, diet's pretty terrible. And so whilst I could do a lot of nutrient testing, gut testing, sometimes I just say to that patient, we're going to fundamentally concentrate on changing that diet and then go to testing maybe in 10 weeks' time. So it really Right. depends on how I've set the file up. I think where a lot of maybe conventional medicine fails is that I don't believe they're looking at some of the fundamental tests, which I do think give you a lot of evidence about various pathways. And they could be anything from a point of view of the nutrient side. I think they're very helpful. I think the microbiome side as well is increasingly helpful. And I also believe, certainly with a lot of the patients that we see, some of the barrier function tests are quite important. But I would say that also with some of the fundamentals that are just really helpful, which might be, you know, the conventionally led testing, it really depends on the patient.
What do you mean by barrier function testing? What would that be?
Well, I think, again, remember, the whole point about why we do so much work at the beginning with a patient is that we're trying to, I always try to say to my patients, look, we're trying to get the best bang for our buck. So what I need to do at the beginning is try and focus on which I think is the most appropriate test that we need. Because, you know, you can test and test and test and test. And I think that's one of the, I think some of the downsides sometimes to functional medicine. I think some people can be over-tested. And, you know, but I would probably say that comes down to probably inexperience as a practitioner. As far as barrier function, so let me give you an example. You've probably heard of the term that they use, leaky gut.
Yes.
So leaky gut can be tested in various ways. And the reason why I think, I mean, depending on the patient, I think that is a good test to do. And what you're looking at there are some of the structural proteins that get more elevated in the blood when the gut lining and gut barrier has been compromised. And remember, your gut should be selectively permeable. And if I take a step back on that, what you've got to think about with regards to your digestive tract, it is the main place where you as a human are sort of sampling the outside world. And how a lot of immunologists want to talk about the gut is that it's not inside the body. It is a tube that if you pulled it straight, both from mouth to anus, there would be a tube there.
Right.
But it is a very important tube because it's where you fundamentally talk to the outside world and traffic the outside world into you. So the gut lining is a really, really important border control. And that's why we think maybe 60 to 70% of your total immune system resides along that lining, because they are part and parcel of your border control.
Wow.
And so what they want to do is preferentially make sure that if there are troublemakers, then they can deal with the troublemakers. But also they're allowing you to sample and select the foods or the bacteria that may or may not want to come across that gut lining. So, and it's a really important part with regards to making sure that your body keeps it in a sort of a natural homeostatic control. For many people on this side is that that gut barrier becomes more compromised, and we can fundamentally measure that. And that can be a real problem, because when that barrier becomes more and more compromised, the risk then is that more and more things can cross the barrier that shouldn't. And when that happens, your immune system has to really react to things that come across. And that can cause a whole host of problems. And this is, again, just to give you an example of this, what we can see is that you can bring in different types of bacteria, particularly what we call a gram-negative bacteria. And they have a particular sort of fatty come sugary molecule that sits on the back of those bacteria. And it's called lipopolysaccharides. And it's, your immune system really does not get on with lipopolysaccharides. And it can induce, if you like, sickness-like behavior, because your immune system is having to respond really aggressively to try and defend against that. And of course, this is part and parcel of the newer theories, or, well, it's not so much the newer theories, but the more nuanced theories now with regards to depression, because I'm pretty sure you know, Liz, that the serotonin theory of depression was debunked a couple of years back from the scientists at UCL. And what we think, and that doesn't mean that low serotonin levels aren't involved with depression or low moods, but we think a lot of depression is down to the fact that people are depressed because they're inflamed, and a lot of that inflammation is coming from an immune system that has to consistently respond to things because they are coming across these barriers and your immune system has to respond. So not only do we see this at the gut barrier, we see this at the oral mucosa. So again, this is why periodontal disease is becoming a keystone disease for other diseases to develop. But we're also seeing this on the blood-brain barrier. And one of the key aspects that we're seeing in the literature with regards to Alzheimer's disease is whether you're having a blood-brain barrier that is more compromised than it should be. And when that case happens, then your immune system of your brain has to respond to invaders into the brain. And again, just one of the things we've got to think about Alzheimer's is that for many, Alzheimer's is an infectious disease. And so when we're looking at Alzheimer's, we have to think about, number one, are there bacteria or other substances that have managed to get through into the brain, and then the brain's own immune system has to respond to them. Now, as it should do. And this is why it's so important to understand barrier function, because if you always have borders that are open, you're always going to have an immune response because things are always going to be coming over. So that's why, particularly with chronic fatigue syndrome, particularly with stuff like Alzheimer's, particularly with depression, certainly some of those barrier function tests, I think, are quite important, certainly in my opinion, to trying to give you a better indication of the bigger picture.
That is absolutely fascinating. And my gosh, there's so much that we could dig into and unpack there. Interesting what you say about the work of UCL medics. We had Professor Joanna Moncrief on the podcast recently doing exactly that, debunking the chemical imbalance theory of depression and, you know, linking it purely to serotonin. And to then relate it to an improved barrier function, blood-brain barrier function. So what would the functional medicine's take be, say, on antidepressants?
Well, look, I think the key on this is that I think the whole point about functional medicine is that you are in a situation where it's got to be completely unique and personalised to the individual, because each individual is unique. It's a really interesting question with regards to antidepressants, and I think it really sort of involves the bigger picture of the patient. So in my experience, obviously I'm not a medical doctor, so what I can't do is that I can't influence the prescribing nature or the decision making around that. What I would tend to do, I mean, we have lots of patients who come in who are on antidepressants, and that's fine. So my role on that side, Liz, was number one, to upset that, but also number two, to actually do the full picture of their health and work on all the mechanisms that may also be involved with regards to why that patient may be depressed. And again, I think we've alluded to some of them that we've just talked about. It's as you say, is that you're looking to get to the point where I think there's a couple of things to think about with antidepressants. They do work in some patients. Mm-hmm. So I think we've got to be careful to suggest that just because the serotonin theory of depression has been debunked, which I think it conclusively has, that doesn't mean to say that you don't have patients with low serotonin levels. And once they're put onto an antidepressive medication, it works for them. I think there's a good argument for that. But I think my argument would be, okay, well, the longer term, why is it you've got low serotonin levels?
That's the thing. It's the why, isn't it? It's not just, you've got low serotonin, so, you know, we can do something about that with a tablet. It's, well, why have you got low serotonin? And yeah. How do we fix
and
that?
And then you start looking at the bigger picture. You know, are these patients, you know, are they generalized? Do they have generalized anxiety? You know, what's happening in their life? Have they had past trauma? What are their relationships? Is their gut function good? Mm-hmm. And so this is where I'm building the sort of the 360 picture that adds into that. And hopefully what you're trying to do there is that set a long-term strategy that by the time they, you know, he may be been working for them for a year to 18 months, you can actually, they may be into a stage where they can actually start stepping down. Now, you've got to be incredibly careful with step down with antidepressants. So, you know, we've got to make sure that if they are going to step down, it's done really well with their GP or whoever their primary care provider is, and it's done over time. And I never recommend that it's done. I always say to our patients, look, if we get to that point, we need to do it in the summer. We certainly don't want to be doing it in the winter.
Right. Yeah, interesting point. Very practical. I mean, we had James Kinross, a consultant surgeon specialising in the gut microbiome, on the show a few weeks ago. And I think from what I'm picking up here is that, you know, you talk about the majority of our immune cells being created in the gut, and this, the reinforcement, the importance of reinforcing this gut barrier, this gut lining, which we know is sort of basically, is it the epithelial cell layer? It's only like one cell thin.
Tiny.
So it's tiny, tiny, tiny. Presumably functional medicine focuses on the importance of gut health as a fundamental.
Well, look, I think you've got to look at it from a point of view of, there's a couple of questions that I always say to our patients when they come in. And I suppose the easiest way to think about this is, what is a human, and what does a human consist of? And I think what we've learned is that we are sort of a little bit more bacterial cells than human cells. That's what makes us up. There's a technical word that we use to describe a human, and that's a holobion.
Right.
And what a holobion is that it's a combination of different species that live together in one vehicle, the human body. And we're always trying to have favorable outcomes for both our bacteria and our human cells. And I think a lot of the sick, chronic people that come to us, I think have been worked up brilliantly from a point of view of conventional medicine, but they haven't asked that question. And a question I always say to our patients is, given that you're more bacterial than human cells, wouldn't it make sense that we actually start looking at the health of your bacteria to give us an indication about whether that's problematic? And so that's where we start exploring that. And again, I see a lot of chronic fatigue patients, fibromyalgia, and, you know, a lot of women who suffer from gut issues. They've got vaginal thrush and bacterial vaginosis. They've got sinus issues. And they are all related to these mucosal surfaces that are dominated by different microbe species. And so I know I want to sort of really investigate that.
So would you be advocating things like taking probiotics to proliferate beneficial bacteria in the gut? You know, what about supplements like butyrate, for example, or actually, you know, having practices that will encourage levels of butyrate in the gut, which from my understanding is going to help reinforce this protective barrier?
Yeah, I think there's a triple answer to that. And I think when obviously the microbiome world has gone crazy over the last 20 years. And so the amount of research coming out on that has been amazing. And I've been very fortunate to be involved with some really great groups. And so there's a couple of things we've got to think about. Number one, we're in a world now where we're looking at prebiotics, probiotics, and postbiotics.
Okay.
And so I suppose the question on that you've asked is it going to be beneficial for me to take a probiotic? And I would say it depends. And it really depends on whether that probiotic is going to be beneficial for your microbiome at that time. And you're probably 50-50, Liz, on that side.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really important to understand the difference, because what a probiotic does, it's a little bit like you're giving a huge amount of policemen to come into the gut and help calm the gut and help control the gut for a period of time. So if you take a probiotic, it's generally going to stay in your system for about 10 days to 2 weeks. It doesn't help you proliferate your own microbiome, but what it does, it's almost like it helps you to stop trouble whilst your own microbiome may be able to start standing on its own two feet again. But really, your own microbiome can only really start to proliferate the sort of the good commensals. And again, remember, your microbiome is, it's always a question of, you want more good guys than bad guys. I think that's the key to think about. And that's where I think plant foods, prebiotics are most helpful. They're the ones that almost are the super fuel for your own microbiome. The probiotics are more the policemen that help control trouble. And importantly, as you say, butyrate, and I'm using a lot of butyrate because I think it's a pretty fantastic product.
Interesting. Am I right in saying that that's a postbiotic?
It's a postbiotic. Now, let me just be clear on this, is that if you have a very high fiber diet, plant foods, they tend to be, with the literature, the most important things for proliferating a really good microbiome. And if you do that, your body makes, and you can test this in stools, Liz. So we do quite a lot of this on testing, because You can test, if you like, the sort of metabolic health of your microbiome, because when it's really healthy and it's being given, I remember we talked about, you know, your bacteria in your around your body, they just want a really nice place to live. And if you give them the right environment, they will do lots of great things for you. And one of the great things that we do, if you feed your microbiome, particularly with a lot of plant foods that have a lot of fiber, they produce a lot of short chain fatty acids, one of them being butyrate. And so you can measure that and you can get an indication from a stool sample, well, how well are we doing here? And butyrate seems to have these amazing properties of not only sort of locally helping calm the immune response at the barrier, the gut barrier, but it also seems to be able to do some pretty spectacular things up at the blood-brain barrier as well. So you've got that gut-brain access that butyrate really seems to do a really good job from.
Brilliant. So as well as eating more fiber, would you suggest a butyrate supplement? Can we take one?
It's difficult to sit on the I'm going to sort of sit on the fence here. And what I would say on that is that we use a lot of supplementation, but it's usually from more targeted information and testing. So I don't think there would be any harm from taking it. But I always go back to the question is that I think you want to take it back to the basics and actually ask that question. Well, you know, just how much plant foods on a daily basis am I getting from my diet? And that would be my first port of call.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. Well, stay there, Pete. We'll come back in a moment and talk more about the practicalities of your prescribed treatments, as well as preventative measures too.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Okay, so let us continue this deep dive. It's such a fascinating subject, and I'd love to really look at perhaps where the brain fits into all of this. As I mentioned in the intro, you were an early adopter of the Professor Dale Bredesen training, which looks to better understand neurodegeneration, things like Alzheimer's. What are the main principles in this school of thought, and how do you apply them to your patients?
Well, I think if we look at the Alzheimer's research, I think this goes with any chronic disease, is there's lots that you can do to offset your risk. On an Alzheimer's, there are some genes that you, certainly one gene in particular, which is the ApoE gene, that you definitely want to get an indication of where you are from that. And again, maybe understanding family history, if there's a significant history of Alzheimer's in the family, then that might be something to think about. But I think for me, understanding your risk of Alzheimer's, I see Alzheimer's as just another chronic disease where some of the fundamental basics of lifestyle seem to be the biggest hitters with regards to making the most risk reduction. So whilst you can get a lot of fancy stuff on that, I think you've got to make sure that you're doing your basics well. And obviously Alzheimer's is more a female related disease.
So more females links into declining estrogen levels.
It does. And do you know what, Liz? It's a really important thing to think about, because it's a really important phase. You know, what is clear on this is that when women go into perimenopause or postmenopause, they lose an incredibly important hormone from a point of view of protecting the brain over many aspects of that brain. You know, an estrogen is incredibly protective for that prefrontal cortex and importantly the hippocampus, you know, which are the memory centers. So this is why when you start getting a woman who's moving into perimenopause or into menopause, you know, they suddenly start forgetting things.
Yeah,
you know, I can't remember anything.
It
really does have estrogen really does have an incredibly important role with regards to helping these sort of neuronal synapses to work effectively. It really has, as I say, strong influence with regards to the hippocampus. And also, as I said to you, what you'll start to see on women as they go into perimenopause, number one, the concentration level is terrible in some of them. The capacity to process things again slows down. And what, again, I think is fascinating on the research is the evidence of when to administrate maybe a HRT.
Yes.
And to help save the brain. I mean, I'm sure you're aware of this, but...
Very much so. Yeah, I've recorded podcasts, Professor Jayashree in Australia, who's done MRI imaging. In fact, I was talking about it in an episode just before Christmas, actually, showing that the dramatic drop in estrogen massively impacting those areas of the brain involved with depression and memory loss, and, you know, leading to Alzheimer's and general neurodegeneration. I mean, this is something that we're only just beginning to kind of document, I guess, clinically, but it's fascinating that, you know, functional medicine practitioners are perhaps more aware of it and presumably, you know, big fans of replacement hormones.
Yeah, so for us, we will, if we've got a female, and again, I think all of these steps, number one, are unique and personal to an individual, and number mm-hmm. two, you know, we've got to make sure that we can work, obviously we're building a pretty big file, but we work with specialist hormone specialists like Dr. Ghazala Scott at the Marion Gluck. She does some work with some of our patients and her team as well, and they are sort of experts of understanding of individualizing, you know, HRT replacement. So it's not that we're taking a sort of you know, a standardized population view with regards to HRT. The HRT has been personalized to that patient based on what we're seeing with regards to hormones. And it's not just about the estrogen replacement, Liz. It's about all the other hormones that work together. And I think this is the key, is that we're always looking at making sure that if we're using hormone replacement, that we're placing the hormone replacement within the bigger picture of, you know, stress hormones like cortisol, DHEA, and all those aspects. So we're trying to, almost in very simple terms, but in very sort of personalized and unique ways, looking at, if we do give HRT, what are the consequences with the whole body health, and what do we need to help and adjust? And that's why, for me, who I think I'm a pretty good conductor of the orchestra, will still need a specialist in certain areas to say, Pete, we'll sort this bit out, and then we'll connect back into you about how we're taking this patient forward.
How do you work with people who come to you suffering from burnout? I mean, that seems to be such a common thing, particularly amongst, you know, kind of stressed out individuals, you know, from city executives just to general, you know, exhaustion in later life. And burnout doesn't sound like a particularly scientific description, but I suspect that it has a very real effect on the body.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty good description, Liz, to be fair, because, you know, I always remember I dealt with one advertising CEO once, and he said, mate, my life is just like living in a twilight zone. I'm just so exhausted from, you know, from the process, is that it's not really living. So I found that quite interesting. There's a couple of things that I find interesting on that, is that it's not that they don't know that they're in trouble. And I think burnout's quite an interesting thing from a point of view of, to really get to the root cause, you've got to get an understanding of your patient. And, you know, and this is what I always say to my patients, I say to them, look, you know, the reality of this is that we've got to get to know each other at a slightly, at a much deeper level. Because if we're just going to do a superficial relationship, we're never going to get to the bottom of things. Because the reality of maybe why you're burnout is down to, you know, the way you grew up, the way you look at things, you know, and the fact that you, you know, why is it that you're working so hard? What is that down to?
My gosh, so that you're even driving in sort of why do you have such a work ethic, not just, you know, why is this disease happening? But you're taking it even further back and thinking, well, there might be a personality or psychological reason that is impacting your physicality.
Well, yeah. So, Liz, I think for most people who are chronically sick, I think that is fundamentally usually a big chunk of the reason. Have to go back and understand the story. They have to be prepared to go on that journey as well. And again, with that, again, particularly with trauma, if we are going to go down that route, and I sort of sniff it out quite quickly that this is a patient that is going to need external help because the way they view the outside world is what's driving their illness to quite a large degree. And as I said to you, I'm a pretty good conductor of the orchestra, but that's when I will say to them, look, I think we need some psychological intervention because the way your brain is viewing the outside world, both from a point of view of genetics and maybe what's happened as you've grown up, etc., is driving the problem. And until we get to understand that a bit better, we're maybe not ever getting to the root cause. What we've been quite clever about is that obviously we can also look into certain genetics. So I'll give you an example of this, which certainly associated with executive burnout, is that I do see quite a lot of executives. And what's quite interesting about them is that a lot of them have dopamine gene deficits. And what I mean by that is that the dopamine cup is never full. You know, and I try and keep this analogy really simple, is that, you know, dopamine is a neurotransmitter that is associated with reward. It's associated with good focus, and it's generally a sort of nice thing to have. And when you get patients who have gene deficits around dopamine, it means that they're more at risk of, number one, having addicted behaviors, low moods, but also, again, you know, I think I can give you an example of binge eating as well. We see this quite a lot. Mm. And so what's going to happen to those patients is every single day humans need to be rewarded. And so when you're talking about burnout, there's another question, you know, is that, you know, how are you being rewarded on a daily basis? Is it you're really fulfilled by work, etc.? And that's great. Because what you start to see with people, number one, stress is the most dominant hormone. It's the most powerful one because it's the only one that really keeps you alive. And so it always dominates the sort of hormonal picture. And whilst stress dominates, some of the feel-good hormones have less of an impact. And so let's imagine you've done a really difficult day. And like everything, you know, your dopamine cup that is already half full because you've got genetics that predispose you, your dopamine cup's pretty empty. So how do you reward yourself? Well, a lot of people, it really is addicted substances, and that could be alcohol, that could be smoking, that could be shopping. See a lot of that,
but it really? Could,
yeah, no, listen, don't get me wrong. I mean, in some, I can think of one patient in particular where we actually asked her to go back to shopping because we knew we were going to stimulate dopamine from that. She was happy, she was getting a little bit more dopamine. So, there's some really sort of unique ways that you can help individuals.
Yeah, I love that. I'm definitely going to come and see if you're going to prescribe more shopping. Pete, there's just so much here that I want to continue talking to you about. I feel that we've only just scratched the surface and there are so many more really practical tips and hints that we can glean from your vast amount of knowledge, having kind of set out the stall, if you like, for the purpose and the areas of functional medicine. I'm wondering whether we can perhaps pick up in a second podcast to follow on from this to actually drill down in some more detail, because I think you're just opening people's eyes and ears, I think, to the possibilities. And it's just so great at this time of year, the beginning of the year, when we might think about starting new regimes and a new way of looking at our healthcare. Would you be up for that?
I'm happy with that, yeah. Yeah, as you can see, I like talking.
I love it. I love that you do. So thank you for today.
Pleasure.
And we'll pick up maybe even next week. Thank you.
Okay, sounds great.
Wow. Okay, there was just so much in there that I really do want to be able to carry on exploring. Things like oral health, nutritional supplements, exercise strategies and tracking. So as a special treat to really kickstart a good and healthy 2024 for us, Pete is going to be back here next week answering even more of my many, many questions. And in the meantime, we touched on previous episodes with Professor Joanna Moncrief and Dr. James Kinross on depression theories and the gut microbiome, respectively. Do scroll back in your feed to listen to those episodes if your interest has been piqued. And if you'd like to listen to those or any future episodes ad-free, do subscribe to the Lizelle Wellbeing Show Plus on Apple Podcasts. That way you get all of those ad-free episodes 24 hours before general release for just a very small monthly fee. Well, are you committed to making this year your healthiest yet? Do sign up to the Lizelle Wellbeing newsletter. It's completely free. You can do that at lizellewellbeing.com. We have two of them, actually. You have to sign up to both if you'd like to receive both of them. One is the editorial newsletter that goes out on a Friday afternoon, packed with lots of things for the weekend. Links to podcasts like this one and offers and features, competitions and more. And then there's one called Liz Loves, which is all the discount codes and money saving offers that goes out on a Tuesday. Well, what would you like your approach to your medical care to look like this year? Do let me know by leaving a comment on Instagram at Lizelle Wellbeing. And I'm also on there too at Lizelle Me. Well, Pete and I will catch you back here next week. Until then, go well. Goodbye. The Lizelle Wellbeing Show is presented by me, Lizelle, and is produced by Anushka Tate for Fresh Air Production, with additional production support from Ellie Smith.